"What have you done to Sir Roderick?" she demanded. Littlefinger was lost. "I feel rather like the knight who arrives at the battle without his lance. What dagger are we talking about? Who is Sir Roderick?"
"Sir Roderick Cassel is master-at-arms at Winterfell," Varys informed him. "I assure you, Lady Stark, nothing at all has been done to the good knight. He did call here early this afternoon. He visited with Sir Aaron Santigar in the armory, and they talked of a certain dagger. About sunset they left the castle together and walked to that dreadful hovel where you were staying. They are still there, drinking in the common room, waiting for your return. Sir Roderick was very distressed to find you gone."
"How could you know all that?"
"The whisperings of little birds," Varys said, smiling. "I know things, sweet lady. That is the nature of my service," he shrugged. "You do have the dagger with you, yes?"
Catelyn pulled it out from beneath her cloak and threw it down on the table in front of him. "Here, perhaps your little birds will whisper the name of the man it belongs to." Varys lifted the knife with exaggerated delicacy and ran a thumb along its edge. Blood welled, and he let out a squeal and dropped the dagger back on the table. "Careful," Catelyn told him. "It's sharp." "Nothing holds an edge like Valyrian steel," Littlefinger said, as Varys sucked at his bleeding thumb and looked at Catelyn with sullen admonition. Littlefinger hefted the knife lightly in his hand, testing the grip. He flipped it in the air, caught it again with his other hand. "Such sweet balance. You want to find the owner. Is that the reason for this visit?" "You have no need of Sir Aaron for that, my lady. You should have come to me."
"And if I had," she said, "what would you have told me?"
"I would have told you that there was only one knife like this at King's Landing." He grasped the blade between thumb and forefinger, drew it back over his shoulder, and threw it across the room with a practiced flick of his wrist. It struck the door and buried itself deep in the oak, quivering. "It's mine."
"Yours?"
It made no sense. But Tyre had not been at Winterfell. "Until the tourney on Prince Joffrey's name day," he said, crossing the room to wrench the dagger from the wood. "I backed Sir Jamie in the jousting, along with half the court." Petar's sheepish grin made him look half a boy again. "When Loras Tyrell unhorsed him, many of us became a trifle poorer. Sir Jamie lost 100 golden dragons. The queen lost an emerald pendant, and I lost my knife. Her grace got the emerald back, but the winner kept the rest."
"Who?" Catelyn demanded, her mouth dry with fear. Her fingers ached with remembered pain.
"The imp," said Littlefinger, as Lord Varys watched her face. "Tyrion Lannister."
John.
The courtyard rang to the sound of swords. On the black wall, boiled leather and mail, sweat trickled icily down John's chest as he pressed the attack. Gren stumbled backward, defending himself clumsily. When he raised his sword, John went underneath it with a sweeping blow that crunched against the back of the other boy's leg and sent him staggering. Gren's downcut was answered by an overhand that dented his helm. When he tried a side swing, John swept aside his blade and slammed a mailed forearm into his chest. Gren lost his footing and sat down hard in the snow. John knocked his sword from his fingers with a slash to his wrist that brought a cry of pain.
"Enough!"
Sir Alistair Thorne had a voice with an edge like Valyrian steel. Gren cradled his hand.
"A bastard broke my wrist."
"A bastard hamstrung you, opened your empty skull, and cut off your hand, or would have if these blades had an edge. It's fortunate for you that the watch needs stable boys as well as rangers."
Sir Alistair gestured at Geron and Toad.
"Get the Oryx to his feet. He has funeral arrangements to make.
John took off his helm as the other boys were pulling Gren to his feet. The frosty morning air felt good on his face. He leaned on his sword, drew a deep breath, and allowed himself a moment to savour the victory.
"That is a long sword, not an old man's cane," Sir Alistair said sharply. "Are your legs hurting, Lord Snow?"
John hated that name, a mockery that Sir Alistair had hung on him the first day he came to practice. The boys had picked it up, and now he heard it everywhere. He slid the longsword back into its scabbard. "No," he replied. Thorn strode towards him, crisp black leather whispering faintly as he moved. He was a compact man of 50 years, spare and hard, with grey in his black hair, and eyes like chips of onyx. "The truth now," he commanded. "I'm tired," John admitted. His arm burnt from the weight of the longsword, and he was starting to feel his bruises now the fight was done.
"What you are is weak."
"I won."
"No, the Oryx lost."
One of the other boys sniggered. John knew better than to reply. He had beaten everyone that Sir Alistair had sent against him, yet it gained him nothing. The master-at-arms served up only derision. Thorn hated him, John had decided. Of course, he hated the other boys even worse.
"That will be all," Thorn told them. "I can only stomach so much ineptitude in any one day. If the others ever come for us, I pray they have archers, because you lot are fit for nothing more than arrow fodder."
John followed the rest back to the armory, walking alone. He often walked alone here. There were almost 20 in the group he trained with, yet not one he could call a friend. Most were 2 or 3 years his senior, yet not one was half the fighter Rob had been at 14. Darien was quick, but afraid of being hit. Pip used his sword like a dagger. Jeren was weak as a girl. Gren, slow and clumsy. Halder's blows were brutally hard, but he ran right into your attacks. The more time he spent with them, the more John despised them. Inside, John hung sword and scabbard from a hook in the stone wall, ignoring the others around him. Methodically, he began to strip off his mail, leather, and sweat-soaked woolens. Chunks of coal burned in iron braziers at either end of the long room, but John found himself shivering. The chill was always with him here. In a few years, he would forget what it felt like to be warm. The weariness came on him suddenly as he donned the rough-spun blacks that were their everyday wear. He sat on a bench, his fingers fumbling with the fastenings of his cloak. So cold, he thought, remembering the warm halls of Winterfell, where the hot waters ran through the walls like blood through a man's body. There was scant warmth to be found in Castle Black. The walls were cold here, and the people colder. No one had told him the Night's Watch would be like this, no one except Tyrion Lannister. The dwarf had given him the truth on the road north, but by then it had been too late. John wondered if his father had known what the war would be like. He must have, he thought. That only made it hurt the worse. Even his uncle had abandoned him in this cold place at the end of the world. Up here, the genial Benjen Stark he had known became a different person. He was a first ranger, and he spent his days and nights with Lord Commander Mormont and Maester Aemon and the other high officers, while John was given over to the less-than-tender charge of Sir Alistair Thorne. 3 days after their arrival, John had heard that Benjen Stark was to lead a half-dozen men on a ranging into the Haunted Forest. That night he sought out his uncle in the great timbered common hall and pleaded to go with him. Benjen refused him curtly. "This is not Winterfell," he told him, as he cut his meat with fork and dagger. "On the wall, a man gets only what he earns. You're no ranger, John, only a green boy with the smell of summer still on you." Stupidly, John argued. "I'll be 15 on my name day," he said, "almost a man grown." Benjen Stark frowned. "A boy you are, and a boy you'll remain until Sir Alistair says you're fit to be a man of the Night's Watch. If you thought your Stark blood would win you easy favours, you were wrong. We put aside our old families when we swear our vows. Your father will always have a place in my heart, but these are my brothers now." He gestured with his dagger at the men around him, all the hard, cold men in black. John rose at dawn the next day to watch his uncle leave. One of his rangers, a big, ugly man, sang a bawdy song as he saddled his garron, his breath steaming in the cold morning air. Ben Stark smiled at that, but he had no smile for his nephew. "How often must I tell you no, John? We'll speak when I return." As he watched his uncle lead his horse into the tunnel, John had remembered the things that Tyrion Lannister told him on the King's Road, and in his mind's eye he saw Ben Stark lying dead, his blood red on the snow. The thought made him sick. What was he becoming? Afterwards he sought out Ghost in the loneliness of his cell and buried his face in his thick white fur. If he must be alone, he would make solitude his armour. Castle Black had no godswood, only a small sept and a drunken septon. But John could not find it in him to pray to any gods, old or new. If they were real, he thought, they were as cruel and implacable as winter. He missed his true brothers, little Rickon, bright eyes shining as he begged for a sweet. Rob, his rival and best friend and constant companion. Bran, stubborn and curious, always wanting to follow and join in whatever John and Rob were doing. He missed the girls, too, even Sansa, who never called him anything but my half-brother, since she was old enough to understand what bastard meant. And Arya. He missed her even more than Rob. Skinny little thing that she was, all scraped knees and tangled hair and torn clothes, so fierce and willful. Arya never seemed to fit no more than he had. Yet she could always make John smile. He would give anything to be with her now, to muss up her hair once more, and watch her make a face, to hear her finish a sentence with him. "You broke my wrist, bastard boy!" John lifted his eyes at the sullen voice. Gren loomed over him, thick of neck and red of face, with three of his friends behind him. He knew Tudder, a short, ugly boy with an unpleasant voice. The recruits all called him Toad. The other two were the ones Yoren had brought north with them, John remembered. Rapers, taken down in the fingers. He'd forgotten their names. He hardly ever spoke to them, if he could help it. They were brutes and bullies, without a thimble of honour between them. John stood up. "I'll break the other one for you if you ask nicely." Gren was 16 and a head taller than John. All four of them were bigger than he was, but they did not scare him. He'd beaten every one of them in the yard. "Maybe we'll break you," one of the rapers said. "Try." John reached back for his sword, but one of them grabbed his arm and twisted it behind his back. "You make us look bad," complained Toad. "You look bad before I ever met you," John told him. The boy who had his arm jerked upward on him, hard. Pain lanced through him, but John would not cry out. Toad stepped close. "The little lordling has a mouth on him," he said. He had pig eyes, small and shiny. "Is that your mummy's mouth, bastard? What was she? Some whore? Tell us her name. Maybe I had her a time or two." He laughed. John twisted like an eel and slammed a heel down across the instep of the boy holding him. There was a sudden cry of pain, and he was free. He flew at Toad, knocked him backwards over a bench, and landed on his chest with both hands on his throat, slamming his head against the packed earth. The two from the fingers pulled him off, throwing him roughly on the ground. Gren began to kick at him. John was rolling away from the blows when a booming voice cut through the gloom of the armory. "Stop this! Now!" John pulled himself to his feet. Donald Noy stood glaring at them. "The yard is for fighting," the armor said. "Keep your quarrels out of my armory, or make them my quarrels, and you won't like that. Toad sat on the floor, gingerly feeling the back of his head. His fingers came away bloody.
He tried to kill me.
It's true, I saw it, one of the rapers put in.
He broke my wrist,
Gren said again, holding it out to Noi for inspection. The armourer gave the offered wrist the briefest of glances.
A bruise. Perhaps a sprain. Maester Aemon will give you a salve. Go to him, Tudder. That head of yours wants looking after. The rest of you, return to your cells. Not you, Snow. You stay.
John sat heavily on the long wooden bench as the others left, oblivious to the looks they gave him, the silent promises of future retribution. His arm was throbbing.
The watch has need of every man it can get, Donalnoy said when they were alone, even men like Toad. You won't win any honours killing him.
John's anger flared. He said my mother was...
Oh, I heard him. What of it?
Lord Eddard Stark was not a man to sleep with whores, John said icily.
His honour did not prevent him fathering a bastard, did it?
John was cold with rage. Can I go?
You go when I tell you to go.
John stared sullenly at the smoke rising from the brazier until Noi took him under the chin, thick fingers twisting his head around.
Look at me when I'm talking to your boy.
John looked. The armourer had a chest like a keg of ale and a gut to match. His nose was flat and broad, and he always seemed in need of a shave. The left sleeve of his black wool tunic was fastened at the shoulder with a silver pin in the shape of a longsword.
Words won't make your mother a whore. She was what she was, and nothing Toad says can change that. You know, we have men on the wall whose mothers were whores.
Not my mother, John thought stubbornly. He knew nothing of his mother. Eddard Stark would not talk of her. Yet he dreamed of her at times. So often he could almost see her face. In his dreams she was beautiful and high-born, and her eyes were kind.
You think you had it hard, being a High Lord's bastard, the armourer went on. That boy Jerren is a Septon's get, and Cutter Pike is the base-born son of a tavern wench. Now he commands Eastwatch by the sea.
I don't care, John said. I don't care about them, and I don't care about you, or Thorn, or Benjen Stark, or any of it. I hate it here. It's too... It's cold.
Yes, cold and hard and mean. That's all. And the men who walk it. Not like the stories your wet nurse told you. Well, piss on the stories, and piss on your wet nurse. This is the way it is. And you're here for life, same as the rest of us.
Life? John repeated bitterly. The armor could talk about life.
He'd had one.
He'd only taken the black after he'd lost an arm at the siege of Storm's End. Before that, he'd smithed for Stannis Baratheon, the king's brother. He'd seen the Seven Kingdoms from one end to the other. He'd feasted and wenched and fought in 100 battles. They said it was Donal Noy who forged King Robert's warhammer, the one that crushed the life out of Rhaegar Targaryen on the Trident. He'd done all the things that Jon would never do. And then, when he was old, well past 30, he'd taken a glancing blow from an axe, and the wound had festered until the whole arm had to come off. Only then, crippled, had Dunlannoy come to the wall, when his life was all but over.
"Yes, life," Noy said. "A long life, or a short one. It's up to you, Snow. The road you're walking, one of your brothers will slit your throat for you one night."
"They're not my brothers," John snapped. "They hate me, because I'm better than they are."
"No, they hate you because you act like you're better than they are. They look at you and they see a castle-bred bastard who thinks he's a lordling."
The armourer leaned close.
"You're no lordling. Remember that. You're a Snow, not a Stark. You're a bastard and a bully."
"A bully?" John almost choked on the word. The accusation was so unjust it took his breath away. "They were the ones who came after me, four of them.
Four that you've humiliated in the yard, four who are probably afraid of you. I've watched you fight. It's not training with you. Put a good edge on your sword, and they'd be dead meat. You know it, I know it, they know it. You leave them nothing, you shame them. Does that make you proud?
John hesitated. He did feel proud when he won. Why shouldn't he? But the armourer was taking that away, too, making it sound as if he were doing something wrong.
You're all older than me, he said defensively. Older and bigger and stronger, that's the truth. I'll wager your master-at-arms taught you how to fight bigger men at Winterfell, though. Who was he? Some old knight?
Sir Roderick Cassel, John said warily. There was a trap here. He felt it closing around him.
Donald Noy leaned forward into John's face. Now think on this, boy. None of these others have ever had a master-at-arms until Sir Alistair. Their fathers were farmers and wagon-men and poachers, smiths and miners, and oars on a trading galley. What they know of fighting, they learned between the decks, in the alleys of Old Town and Lannisport, in wayside brothels and taverns on the King's Road. They may have clacked a few sticks together before they came here, but I promise you, not one in 20 was ever rich enough to own a real sword.
His look was grim.
So how do you like the taste of your victories now, Lord Snow?
Don't call me that, John said sharply, but the force had gone out of his anger. Suddenly, he felt ashamed and guilty.
I didn't think... Best you start thinking, Noy warned him. That, or sleep with a dagger by your bed. Now, go.
By the time John left the armory, it was almost midday. The sun had broken through the clouds. He turned his back on it and lifted his eyes to the wall, blazing blue and crystalline in the sunlight. Even after all these weeks, the sight of it still gave him the shivers. Centuries of wind-blown dirt had pocked and scoured it, covering it like a film, and it often seemed a pale grey, the colour of an overcast sky. But when the sun caught it, fair on a bright day, it shone, alive with light, a colossal blue-white cliff that filled up half the sky. The largest structure ever built by the hands of man, Benjen Stark had told John on the King's Road, when they had first caught sight of the wall in the distance.
And beyond a doubt, the most useless, Tyrion Lannister had added with a grin.
But even the imp grew silent when they rode closer. You could see it for miles off, a pale blue line across the northern horizon, stretching away to the east and west, and vanishing in the far distance, immense and unbroken. This is the end of the world, it seemed to say. When they finally spied Castle Black, its timbered keeps and stone towers looked like nothing more than a handful of toy blocks scattered on the snow, beneath the vast wall of ice. The ancient stronghold of the Black Brothers was no Winterfell, no true castle at all. Lacking walls, it could not be defended, not from the south or east or west, but it was only the north that concerned the Night's Watch, and to the north loomed the wall. Almost 700 feet high it stood, three times the height of the tallest tower in the stronghold it sheltered. His uncle said the top was wide enough for a dozen armored knights to ride abreast. The gaunt outline of huge catapults and monstrous wooden cranes stood sentry up there like the skeletons of great birds, and among them walked men in black, as small as ants. As he stood outside the armory looking up, John felt almost as overwhelmed as he had that day on the King's Road, when he had seen it for the first time. The wall was like that. Sometimes he could almost forget that it was there, the way you forget about the sky or the earth underfoot, but there were other times when it seemed as if there was nothing else in the world. It was older than the Seven Kingdoms, and when he stood beneath it and looked up,
It made John dizzy. He could feel the great weight of all that ice pressing down on him, as if it were about to topple, and somehow John knew that if it fell, the world fell with it.
"Makes you wonder what lies beyond," a familiar voice said.
John looked round. "Lannister, I didn't see... I mean, I thought I was alone." Tyrion Lannister was bundled in fur so thickly he looked very like a small bear.